From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
It's not what he said, it's what he didn't say. I'm Warren Alney, and this is To the Point. In deference to President Trump, NATO leaders agreed not to focus on Russia during this week's summit. At today's opening session, they hoped he'd endorse the alliance's Article 5. That's the principle that an attack on one member nation is an attack on all. Instead, he lectured about defense spending and fairness to the United States, even though the only time NATO's ever invoked Article 5 was after September 11th. What are the consequences for Europe's trust in America as the leader of the free world since World War II? Later on today's Talking Point, the Harvard Business School, the MBA Industrial Complex, and income inequality. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. The Harvard Business School graduates a new class of MBAs today. On our Talking Point later, a critical look at what golden passports have meant for American business and the world economy. First, this news update. At the opening of NATO's dramatic new headquarters in Brussels today, President Trump acknowledged that Article 5, promising that an attack on one nation is an attack on all, has only been invoked one time, in the aftermath of September 11th.
We remember and mourn those nearly 3,000 innocent people who were brutally murdered by terrorists on September 11th, 2001. Our NATO allies responded swiftly and decisively, invoking for the first time in its history the Article 5 collective defense commitments.
But the president failed to provide what 27 other alliance members have been waiting for, a recommitment by America's new leader to Article 5. Instead, they got a scolding.
But 23 of the 28 member nations are still not paying what they should be paying and what they are supposed to be paying for their defense. This is not fair to the people and taxpayers of the United States.
John Hudson, foreign affairs correspondent for BuzzFeed News, joins us from Brussels. John, great to have you on our program.
Yeah, great to be here.
The leaders of the alliance, the other leaders, backed off what they care about most, which is Russia, in deference to Mr. Trump. They laid on the pomp and circumstance, and they were hoping to get a commitment, a recommitment, I should say, to Article 5. Why is it so important?
Yeah, well, especially for some of the European allies who are in Eastern Europe and Baltic allies who feel particularly threatened by Russia, they wanted to hear that if they were to be bullied or threatened or even attacked by Russia and explicitly attacked, that Article 5 would trigger and the United States would come in to the defense of those countries. Obviously, that's a huge priority for them because the United States, being the largest military power in the world, is a great sort of insurance card, and they want to be able to have a valid insurance card, and that's what Article 5 is all about.
The leaders of the other nation were standing in that massive arena that is now the new headquarters of NATO. How did they react very specifically to what he said?
It certainly was a tight-lipped sort of impression that was left on their faces. It's hard to distinguish what's really going through anybody's heads while they're listening to the speech. It certainly didn't seem like they greeted his scolding of needing to spend more money on their own defense in a welcoming way. And one thing that we do know is Trump repeated his viewpoint that NATO allies owe a lot of money from failing to pay 2% of their GDP in previous years. European officials have repeatedly said in advance of the summit they categorically reject that idea. So there were a number of reasons why they might not have been super enthusiastic about the words that Trump was saying.
There appear to be some raised eyebrows and even laughter from some of the leaders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you could catch some of them even sort of having a quick chat with each other while Trump was making this widely anticipated speech. So it was very clear that those weren't necessarily the people that Trump was trying to really appeal to in a way of getting necessarily applause. He made very clear that he was making this speech in defense of the American taxpayer, who he serves first and foremost.
So he really wasn't speaking to that audience, and yet that audience, internationally speaking, is important. Are they worried about him? Are the allies now less likely to cooperate with the United States?
Well, it's yet to be seen. In terms of worry, that's absolutely true. I was talking to a number of Baltic defense officials earlier this week, Lithuanians, Latvians. They were saying that it is extremely important for them to hear it, specifically from the president's mouth. Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, the Vice President have all said that that Article 5 stands, but they wanted to hear from the president because, of course, the president has been the one who has been so skeptical about NATO in general throughout his entire political campaign and even early days of his presidency.
He has called NATO obsolete during an interview with the New York Times, so that's going about as far as you can. On the other hand, as you indicated, not only the vice president, but the secretary of state, the secretary of defense, his own national security advisor have all said that we're still committed to Article 5. He did acknowledge that it had been invoked on behalf of the U.S. after 9/11, but that's not enough?
That's important. So now this is up for dispute. So while he acknowledged that, that's basically just a fact. That's not something that was previewed to the press, which was that there was going to be an explicit endorsement of Article 5. Now, what's an important development to note is that White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer recently just held a gaggle after the speech with reporters, saying that he was, you know, quote, perplexed that this question is even being asked. He said, of course, President Trump supports Article 5. This was a speech surrounding the commemoration of Article 5 itself. He didn't specifically endorse it. So that was an important thing that people were looking for. And this White House was very familiar with the fact that people were looking for that explicit endorsement.
All right. They want to hear it from the horse's mouth. John Hudson, again, foreign affairs correspondent for BuzzFeed News, joins us from Brussels. We'll be back in a moment and continue this conversation about the NATO summit, the first one for President Trump. This is To the Point from Public Radio International.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point, once again talking about President Trump's first summit meeting of NATO. It's called a mini-summit rather than a summit. It's only going to go on for a couple of days. But the one thing that the other leaders wanted to hear, the other 27 NATO alliance members, he didn't say, which was a recommitment formally from his lips, not just from his staff or from the vice president, a recommitment to Article 5. John Hudson, still with us with the BuzzFeed News. You were there. Once again, tell us how to what extent they went out of their way, the other leaders, not to talk about Russia, which you said many of them are extremely concerned about.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the alliance is a little bit, split on this. Western European countries, many of them, are not extremely enthused about beating Russia over the head or ominous talk about Russia. They have financial ties, talking about countries like Italy and, in some cases, large parts of the German political scene. But it is true, and I confirmed this with NATO earlier in the week, that the two main topics for the working dinner that's going on right now are counterterrorism and burden sharing, financial sharing. It's not Russia. And, of course, we're talking about an alliance that was founded off the very premise of deterring, what was, the Soviet Union. So, a lot of people have raised this as surprising that this isn't the focus. And it was just very clear to NATO organizers that basing this on Russia would have been tone deaf to what has been longstanding complaints that Trump has about the alliance. It's not that we don't talk about Russia enough. It's that we don't talk about counterterrorism enough, and that the alliance doesn't talk enough about burden sharing. So they were very sensitive to those demands.
He's also wrapped up in a scandal having to do with Russia, or at least a sort of burgeoning scandal here in this country. Are they aware of that?
Absolutely. Nobody misses the headlines. And, this is a sophisticated group of world leaders. So they could have also been sensitive to the fact that that Trump has repeatedly said that the investigations surrounding his campaign contacts to Russia is a story that is fake news. And that's also a reason they might be mindful of the fact that that centering the entire mini-summit on this would not be music to his ears.
Okay. John Hudson, again, a foreign affairs correspondent for BuzzFeed News, once again in Brussels for the opening of that new headquarters and President Trump's speech. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Julianne Smith is a senior fellow, director of the Strategy and Statecraft Program at the Center for New American Security. She was the deputy national security advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Good to be back.
What do you make of all this, and how do you think they're responding to it in Russia?
I think Moscow is probably sitting back and enjoying this, probably smiling, a little bit giddy. Moscow has been doing what it can in recent years to undermine the transatlantic relationship and the institutions associated with it. And Putin has made it no secret that he would love to see NATO kind of fade into history. And so to have a U.S. president stand up and address all of the member states of the alliance and not reaffirm America's commitment to Article 5 certainly makes our adversaries, particularly those sitting in Moscow, breathe a sigh of relief because it does raise questions about the degree to which the United States is going to be willing to come to other allies' aid should Russia or anyone else do something or threaten a NATO ally.
He has said in the past, during the campaign particularly, that America might not be willing to come to their aid unless they had been paying up, if they weren't freeloaders, a term he didn't use today, but one he has used in the past. Do you think that that has caused them to simply lose faith in the United States and its willingness to be helpful?
Well, that New York Times interview that Trump gave during the campaign, where he suggested that our commitment to Article 5 could, as you noted, very well be conditional based on whether or not they're meeting the 2% target, did raise a lot of eyebrows across the European continent. European allies, on the other hand, were reassured when they heard several members of Trump's cabinet come to the Munich Security Conference in February and say that NATO was a key part of America's foreign policy, that we were not downgrading our relationship with NATO. We had faith in the NATO alliance, that our commitment was unwavering. But allies needed to hear it from the president himself, and it would have been a very easy win for the president to put in one line into that speech today that would have enabled everyone to step back and realize that there was no need to question America's commitment to this alliance. Now that Trump has not said it, unless he said it at the dinner tonight, we'll get a readout shortly from Brussels. But now that he didn't say it in his public speech, once again, there are all sorts of open-ended questions about America's commitment to the security of our European allies.
And as to the dinner, it is Russia is simply not on the agenda. Article 5 is not on the agenda. Only the issues of terrorism and burden sharing, as it's called. That's what, of course, Mr. Trump is referring to. Christopher Preble is with us. He's director of foreign policy studies at the Libertarian Cato Institute. Thanks to you for being on our show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What about the argument that the president is making, that the other nations have agreed to spend 2% of their gross national product on defense or gross domestic product, and in fact, they're not doing it? Only Greece, interestingly enough, Britain, Estonia, and Poland. After that, it goes down. France, 1.78%. Turkey, 1.56%. Does that matter?
I think it does matter to Americans who are wondering about, you know, the state of the U.S. economy, where the United States spends its money, how the United States spends its money. But the first point is, when NATO was created, of course, the United States wasn't looking for burden sharing. The United States was looking, as the first secretary of NATO said, to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. The purpose of NATO was to discourage European countries from spending more on defense. And at the time when it was created, it made perfect sense. These were poor, weak countries. They were vulnerable to a Soviet Union lodged in Eastern Europe. The Soviet Union was a common enemy, and the United States was in a position to keep them safe, to be a credible deterrent to Soviet aggression. Of course, what has changed is that these countries have become wealthy, and they continue to spend far, far less than the United States, not merely as a percentage of GDP, but also on a per capita basis. Of course, the collective GDP of Europe is larger than that of the United States. So if the European countries were spending even less than 2%, they would be able to generate far, far greater military capability than they do right now.
Some of them have become wealthy, but certainly Greece hasn't, and it's after the United States, which spends 3.61%. Greece is next, 2.38%.
Right. It's an argument that the Greeks are also not making good decisions about where they're spending their money.
So each country, obviously, has this kind of an argument to wrestle with. Back to Julian Smith, formerly with the Biden administration. What about this? Has the United States been willing to give the freeloaders a break?
Well, this has been a debate that's been going on for a very long time. Many, many secretaries of defense and American presidents have pleaded with our European allies to do more, and they've been right to do so. European allies have made pledges to increase defense spending, but for many years, they really have failed to deliver on those pledges. And so Trump, like many others, is certainly right to raise the point and to push our European allies to do more. That said, I think what some have missed is that the trend changed in 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea and went into Ukraine. That obviously got everyone's attention in Europe, and it produced a summit right after that where allies pledged to get to that 2% target in 10 years. Many of them are on track to do so. Some of them are still neglecting to make progress on that pledge, but many of them are making progress. We'll have a couple new members to the club that are hitting that 2% target just in the next couple of years. And then others like Germany will have to wait much longer. That will take the better part of 10 years because of the size of their budget and GDP and the fact that they're only spending close to 1% right now. But I think Trump is trying to give folks the impression that he is the only person that can move the needle. And I think he certainly scared some of the allies to see if they could accelerate their plans. But there doesn't seem to be much of an appreciation with this administration that, in fact, Putin has done a lot to motivate our European allies to make changes in that regard as well.
Christopher Preble, you talked about whether one country or another is spending reasonably. What about NATO itself, the $1 billion new headquarters we all got to look at on television today is massive.
Yes.
It's beautiful, but it cost $1 billion.
That's right. And you think that someone like Donald Trump, who made his living building buildings, has a few things to say about the cost. Let me respond to something that Julie said, because I don't really fault the European countries for not spending more on defense. I mean, after all, if someone offers to pay for my security, I'm not inclined to pay for it myself. And again, this was exactly the bargain that we cut with the European member states of NATO. We said to them in the earliest days of the Cold War, you're not in a position to defend yourself. You're trying to rebuild your economies. We understand that. And so while it's true that secretaries of defense, a parade of them, have said publicly that they want European countries to spend more, privately, one of the benefits that many of the advocates of NATO proclaim is that it has dampened the likelihood of various European states to do more to defend themselves. That was one of the key benefits of European security guarantees. So I think we just need to be honest with the American people and just say, look, the purpose of this alliance is not merely to expand total military capabilities. It is to, frankly, discourage some countries from developing more military capabilities than American leaders think they should have.
Okay, so once again, American judgments are important to all of this. I want to go a little closer to Russia, which is seen by so many of them as the major thing to be concerned about, and the original reason at the time that it was the Soviet Union and some of the countries now in Eastern Europe were part of it. Steve Clemens is political and foreign policy analyst. He's also a Washington editor at large of The Atlantic. He is now in Slovakia. Steve Clemens, great to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Warren.
What about people in that part of the world, and how do you think they're reacting to what happened today in Brussels?
Well, I'm at a meeting now in Slovakia at a forum called GlobeSec, and there will be the foreign and defense ministers of many of the Eastern European countries here for a major post-NATO conference tomorrow. Those attachés and planners that are here are completely dismayed and shocked by Donald Trump's real refusal, given what we now know, that his military advisors, his national security advisor, pushed him hard to embrace Article 5. The mere fact that we know there's a gap between what his military advisors advised him to do, what the expectations and aspirations of people here are, and what Donald Trump did is shocking. So when you ask that question, I'll just tell you, there is palpable doubt today among our allies in NATO about the dependability of the United States in this relationship. This is a de Gaulle moment, you know, that they feel, as Angela Merkel once articulated, that perhaps they need to begin thinking about alternatives. And they're in a vice because these countries want nothing more than to snap back into the kind of relationship and alliance and cooperation and collaboration with the United States that they used to have. But they all know that they have to pretend to be polite to the United States, but they know it no longer exists. The planks just fell out of the floor today.
Slovakia, of course, is a member of NATO. What are some of the other countries that also are members who feel the same way that you just described?
Well, the ones that I'll be seeing tomorrow, and they're complicated countries right now. I'll be interviewing the foreign ministry of Hungary tomorrow, the foreign ministry of Poland. Poland, these countries, when I was here a year ago, when you look back at the Warsaw NATO summit and some of the topics that were raised at that time on their concerns about hybrid war, their concerns about cyber, their concerns about wanting to get a more of a manned presence that included U.S. military troops into some of these Eastern European countries and the Baltics. That was the agenda. So when Donald Trump today pushes terrorism, burden sharing, but really immigration and these kind of other, you know, left field topics, they're, you know, these countries here, at least the ones in this is sort of the alternative conference to the annual Munich Security Conference for mainly a European, Eastern European town. These are the nations that have been perhaps the strongest defenders of the United States in real years within the European and NATO relationship, that felt that the American partnership was something that they wanted to double down in, that sent troops willingly and eagerly to fight with ours in Afghanistan, because they feel the real pressure from Russia. But what they're facing today is they see Donald Trump kicking their leaders in the teeth, shoving them out of the way, as we saw with the Prime Minister of Macedonia today, and doing, you know, backslabbing and glad-handing with the Russian foreign minister in the Oval Office, particularly after part of what the Syrian missile strikes was about was to send Russia a signal. That all looks not. So there's
okay, hold your fire, because we need to go to a break. We are captives of the clock on radio, so we're going to take a break. We'll come back and we'll hear more, particularly about what happened with the Prime Minister of Macedonia. Again, this is To the Point. On our talking point later, the Harvard Business School, the MBA Industrial Complex, and income inequality. That's later. We'll come back with this conversation on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking for the moment about Donald Trump's first NATO summit meeting and how he failed to commit openly and publicly, in his own words, to Article 5 of the NATO Charter, which says that an attack on one country is an attack on all. It's only been invoked once. That was after 9/11. And yet the president wouldn't go along with it. We've heard arguments about his concern that the other countries aren't spending enough on their own defense and relying on the United States. So quickly, Steve Clemens, back to you now in Slovakia, a member of the United Nations. You said that they really feel that country and others who were, of course, part of the Soviet Union, they know what Russia is about more than anybody else. Elaborate a little bit on that, if you will. And what happened today in Brussels that regarded they called you to say that one of the prime ministers got pushed around?
Well, I mean, I drove from Vienna, where I landed today, into Slovakia, and there's this big border cross point, which you can go through without incident. But that was the old line between the free world and the unfree world, sure. The communist world. And it's palpable. You sort of feel that. And I think people here in Eastern Europe want to make this relation. I mean, it is interesting because, you know, the dance that many of us do right now is they try to want to believe that America is going to be with them in their dark days. But what's happened is Jim Mattis, H.R. McMaster, John Kelly, lots of folks that Julianne Smith and Chris Preble and I know are really good people and good advisors around Donald Trump. But when it comes to the core, when it comes to, you know, the person running the show, this person very clearly is calculating that he's sending shockwaves into the planning of our allies. And maybe sometimes that can be useful. Maybe that then crunches out inertia in these relations. Then you fight for what you want and need. But when you see him simultaneously backslapping the Russians, making it easy for them while he's under investigation, as you pointed out earlier, it makes no sense. And it has created this fabulous fear among them that the world is coming apart, and the world as they knew it, the nature of American power in the world is coming to an end, and that has tremendous implications for them. What was very odd and sad today was to see in many of the visuals, despite the look of dismayed leaders talking and just in shock or smiling in kind of a weird way at Donald Trump's comments, was that when the leaders were walking, he actually shoved the Prime Minister of Macedonia out of his way so he could jump up front. And that's gone viral on the internet now, saying here's the way America first looks to the world. So it's a rudeness, a pugnaciousness, and arrogance in 3D form.
Okay. You're sure it was Macedonia and not...
I really try to give Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt on these things, but we've reached a tipping point where the world no longer trusts us. And I think those of us in the talking class need to figure out what does that mean. And, you know, we want to hedge our bets, hoping it's going to snap back. But it is not. We're at a very different point today after what has just transpired.
All right. You said Macedonia. Others have said it was the Prime Minister of Montenegro, another member of NATO. No doubt that'll be cleared up. But there was another thing that was hanging over this meeting. And, of course, it's very close to what President Trump is concerned about, and that is what happened in Manchester, the attack there. And Adrian Wooldridge is with us. He's political editor and a Badgett columnist for The Economist. He previously was the Washington bureau chief for that magazine. And, Adrian, good to have you back on our program.
Good to be here.
How concerned is Britain about NATO's attention to the issue of terrorism? And is NATO equipped, given what we've heard about its early founding and what it does today, to do what the president is asking it to do?
Well, Britain is one of the very few countries that actually spends 2% of its GDP on defense. We're very concerned about NATO. And I think we do believe absolutely that NATO has two important roles. One is to defend the world against Russian expansionism, and the other is to defend the world against terrorism in various ways. So we're very enthusiastic about NATO. We're very enthusiastic about all other countries spending more of their money on defense and meeting the 2% target. And we're very concerned about both, keeping Russia in line, and also doing more to use NATO to deal with deal with terrorism. So we're very committed to NATO here.
Another issue that's arisen that has to do with the trustworthiness of the United States is the leaking of intelligence information about what happened in Manchester. Tell us what information was leaked, who used it, and what the concerns now are in Britain about that.
Well, it's absolutely appalling behavior by the American security services, whoever did it. There's information about what sort of bomb was used. There's information about the ongoing investigation as to who did this appalling thing. And Britain has now, I think, formally terminated its relationship, or suspended, I should say, its relationship with the security services in the United States until this issue of the leaking of information comes up, has been resolved. We've had a picture of the sort of bloody carnage and of the device that was used in Manchester on the front page of the New York Times. You have a very leaky security service. It's very unprofessional conduct. And unfortunately, this is not just an issue with Trump, who obviously has leaked in various other ways. It's an issue which also happened in the aftermath of the 7/7 bus bombings in London. We had exactly the same thing, a very intensive cooperation between the British security services and the American security services, then terminated for a while, suspended for a while, because of the American security services leaking information back in 2007. So there is a systemic problem, it seems, there.
And one other thing, if President Trump was, to some extent, speaking to his own supporters here in this country when he talked about the burden-sharing issue, Theresa May, the Prime Minister of Britain, is up for re-election herself, and she had to serve her party is. And here's what she had to say on her way to the NATO meeting in Brussels.
I will make clear to President Trump that intelligence that is shared between our law enforcement agencies must remain secure.
Adrian Wildridge, back to you. Does anybody think President Trump will be intimidated by Theresa May and keep his mouth shut?
Well, whether President Trump is intimidated by anybody is questionable. Whether he's going to keep his mouth shut, unfortunately, not questionable at all, because he doesn't do that sort of thing. But Britain is a very close ally of the United States. Britain has been closer to the United States in the Trump era than any other country. I would hope that he would take a certain amount of notice of that. And I think it's just incredibly unprofessional conduct on the part of the security services to leak information in the middle of an ongoing investigation. So perhaps something will come of that. I mean, Mr. Trump has got problems with his own leaking of information in other contexts. I hope he will listen to her.
Steve Clemens, back to you with The Atlantic magazine now in Slovakia for the meeting there. I'm no doubt people there noticed the leaking of intelligence. And how concerned are they about that?
Well, I don't know which of these countries in Eastern Europe would be. They're all part of intelligence sharing, of course,
sure,
at one level. But the Five Eyes platform, among America's closest allies, is the arena that Adrian was really referring to. It's where the element of highest trust exists. But I think more broadly, there is among those allies that we have in NATO, certainly there's intelligence that's shared with them. And they're all dealing with, as we know, refugee challenges, domestic terrorism questions, you know, the notion of tracking people across borders that either have gone, as in the recent case in Manchester, to places like Libya or Syria, potentially having been connected by some association, digitally tracked one way or another to some of these folks that have been engaged in these networks. That requires a degree of trust and information sharing. And I have to say, and I think Adrian would agree, that the Europeans have taken a long time, a very long time, to get to a level of trust with the United States on information. There is something about Europe, about data protection, and that has had an allergy to the kind of churning through data that the United States has been really a champion and promulgated. And I think that this now resurrects those doubts within and throughout Europe about being able to trust America. So this reopens old wounds that had probably been solved. And we'll find out tomorrow at this GlobeSec conference the degree to which that continues to be there. But in my sideline chats, the big thing you get here is just sort of a generic doubt, a generic dismay, a generic disbelief in what's going on in our country. And I think that is something that when you're a serious war planner, you're looking at scenarios that may unfold, you can't live in a Wilsonian world of hoping you're going to get the partner and relationship you'd like to have. You have to look at things as they are. What do you have today? What can you depend on? And that is in the area of intelligence, in the area of dealing with, you know, Russia's malfeasance in places around the world, or dealing with some of these issues that are very dicey, okay, like nuclear nonproliferation and others. These are issues, and they doubt the partnership with the United States today.
Julie Smith, you worked for Vice President Joe Biden. The Obama administration was the one that has done more than any other to try to stop leaking and has been criticized for going too far. What do you say to the fact that Mr. Trump has now said he's ordered an investigation of the leaks of the in connection with Manchester that Adrian Wooldridge and others are so concerned about? And is this systemic with the United States, not just involving the Trump administration and the president himself?
Well, leaks are a fact of life, sadly, in government, and we've seen that increase over the years and become more and more of a problem. I mean, we reached a point in the Obama administration where sometimes it felt like, you know, minutes after walking out of a very sensitive and classified discussion, you'd read about it on Twitter or, you know, somewhere in social media. And so it was a concern during the Obama administration. It's been a concern even before then. It's no, you know, surprise that this administration's grappling with it as well. But this has taken it to a completely new place because of the friction inside the administration between a lot of the career civil servants and the new political team that's settling in, the animosity that's built up, and the need for people feel the need to then leak and try and clarify what's going on behind the scenes. And it's turned into, obviously, a huge distraction and raised enormous questions about the health of our democratic system, about good governance, about the way in which we conduct our intelligence relationships with our allies, and now will continue to be a point of friction in a number of our very sensitive but also very, very important and valuable intelligence relationships, most notably with the UK and Israel, as we've seen just unfold on this trip. So it's worrying. It's not going away. And I fear that it's going to worsen with this administration.
Christopher Preble, back to you, Director of Foreign Policy Studies at the Libertarian Cato Institution. Julie Smith indicated there already are problems between the career people and new people. But Mr. Trump hasn't appointed a lot of people. There are a lot of vacancies. Does he have an opportunity to try to fill the holes in this leaky system?
I think that there's a lot of concern. Steve spoke of doubt, dismay, and disbelief. I think those words describe not just people in Europe, but people in the United States as well. There is genuine concern about the competence of this administration, the problems of unfilled positions, the problem of communication. We've been waiting for President Trump and his team to get their act together, and it just doesn't seem to be getting any better. And I think this, again, speaks to there is a very sad situation. I don't dispute that at all for a number of our European allies who had counted upon the United States to be, if nothing else, competent at providing security. They now have reasons to doubt that, as well as to doubt the commitment of the president himself to this entire enterprise.
Okay.
So I think there are some very serious concerns about this administration across the board.
Adrian Wilbridge with The Economist. Despite what we've heard from our three American guests, there are different standards of press freedom in Britain than there are in the United States. Julie Smith said they had to recognize that leaks were going to be a fact of life. How important is that, the different attitude toward press freedom here as opposed to Britain and other places?
Well, I mean, we have a very free press here, and we have a very rambunctious press here. And as a journalist myself, there's nothing I like more than great leaks. But I think when you're dealing with an ongoing intelligence investigation into a terrorist act in which more than 50 people, many of them children, have been killed. And when that investigation is actively looking for possible perpetrators of another terrorist act, because we're under sort of a critical condition warning here that another terrorist act is imminent, when you're in that sort of circumstance, I think it's, you know, leaking to the press is, particularly if the leaks are coming from people in the intelligence services, is on a wholly different level. This is not, you know, a budget or something like that.
So do you think this will continue? And again, you said that Britain has suspended its relationship with American intelligence agencies. Do you see others doing the same thing?
Well, I think Israel has suspended its relationship recently with American intelligence agencies as well over problems with leaks. So I think it is an ongoing problem. And you have two sets of problems. You have the conduct of the president in the Oval Office, and then you have lower-level people who seem to think it's clever or in some way advances either their careers or their sense of their self-importance to leak to the press.
Okay, obviously a lot of issues remain, and we've got to run. Adrian Wooldridge, Badgett columnist with The Economist, Steve Clemens with the Atlantic Magazine, Christopher Preble with the Cato Institute, Julie Smith now with the Center for a New American Security, former with the Vice President's Office, Vice President Biden, John Hudson, our earlier guest from BuzzFeed News. In a moment, an author who wasn't invited to today's graduation ceremonies at the Harvard Business School. We'll find out why. This is To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Warren Alney here with today's Talking Point. Despite enormous influence, the Harvard Business School admits it has strategic problems. It concedes, for example, it may perpetuate inequality. That's just one of the accusations in a new book called The Golden Passport, Harvard Business School, The Limits of Capitalism and the Moral Failure of the MBA Elite. The author is Duff McDonald. Welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the title. Why or how is a Harvard Master in Business Administration a golden passport?
You know, the title came out of a phrase in a New York Times article I came across while researching the book from the 1970s. And on the occasion of MBA's starting salaries topping $25,000, the reporter wrote that an MBA from HBS is indeed a golden passport to the good life. And when I read that, it just jumped out at me, and I said, that's the title of the book.
That was big money in the 1970s.
Yeah.
Certainly to start out with. Well, the Harvard Business School, the HBS, was founded in 1908, supposedly as a force for good in a capitalist economy. It claims to have helped build the American economy and win the Second World War. Is that true?
Yeah, the school came into being when business in America emerged as a calling that, you know, was starting to compete with the professions, the clergy, law, the military. And because it was Harvard, they didn't want a vocational school. They wanted a school that would train an enlightened managerial elite. And for at least half a century, that seems to be what they were doing. They helped lay the foundations of American managerial expertise. They did turn themselves into a bit of a military school during the Second World War, doing a lot of statistical logistics work. And for the first half of their existence, I would argue that they certainly were meeting their self-imposed obligation to create graduates who want to make a difference in the world.
When did it go awry?
It's hard to pinpoint that exactly, but, you know, the era, I would argue, is probably the 70s and 80s when American management was revealed as not quite as omnipotent as everyone had been led to believe in the post-war years. it's not that hard to compete when your competition has been literally bombed out of existence. And when the profit pie started shrinking and the whole idea that greed was acceptable entered the economy in the Reagan era, the school essentially turned its back on its heritage and threw its lot in with the money.
One of the people that you say was instrumental in all of that was Michael Jensen, hired by the Harvard Business School in the 1980s. Why do you single him out?
Jensen was the flag waver for something called agency theory, which argued that because managers and shareholders didn't always necessarily have their objectives in line, that management needed to be motivated with the carrot of stock options, and that would bring them in line with shareholders, which he and others, including Milton Friedman, argued were the true and rightful owners of every public company. The problem with that is there's too many problems with that. One is shareholders are not the only owners of a company. You know, if you don't believe that, try taking your share of anything and going to the company and asking for your piece of it. It's a piece of paper. The other thing is, in arguing that managers were essentially the types of people who needed to be motivated by bigger and bigger awards, he effectively helped lower the estimation of management in its own eyes, and everyone then decided, well, if it's every man for himself, then it's going to be every man for himself, and that started the greatest money hunt in MBA history, and that was Wall Street in the 80s.
So this has led to the vast difference in pay between CEOs and other managers and the people who work for the companies. You make a distinction between shareholder capitalism and stakeholder capitalism. What do you mean?
Stakeholder capitalism is not a new idea. It goes back decades, and it basically says that there's more than one constituency who deserves the benefits of, you know, that which we create when we are collaborating and working together. And that would include employees, communities, country. This is sort of a mass delusion. If you look at accounting principles in the United States, right, shareholders' equity is considered an asset, whereas the salary you pay your employees is considered an expense and therefore translates into a liability. We've been looking at things the wrong way for so long that everyone finally just sort of threw up their hands and said, fine, shareholders win. And for at least a quarter of a century, we've had share price as our North Star in this country. When it's the last thing it should be. We should be trying to create things that make life better for everyone rather than just one single constituency, which is the shareholders of a company.
You mentioned Milton Friedman, who said the social responsibility of business is to increase its profits. He was at the University of Chicago. Why focus so much on the Harvard Business School? Aren't you really indicting the whole economy and the way that it's run or the way that it's theoretically regarded and managed by the people who run it?
It's a good point. You know, schools of economics, including Chicago, which is obviously one of the most influential, are one part of the intellectual backdrop of the economy. But what I would call the MBA industrial complex has grown so huge. We graduate tens of thousands of MBAs every single year and are somehow living under the mass delusion that an MBA therefore qualifies someone to be a better decision maker than people with actual experience. You know, you could write a book about how different schools of economics have got it wrong. But what I want to do is look at, okay, what is this thing, the MBA? And if we're going to look at it, how are we going to look at it? And having decided that, through the prism of Harvard Business School was the easiest decision because they are the oldest, the most famous, the most influential, and still to this very day, the most effective at catalyzing the careers of their graduates.
So it is then symptomatic as well as a causing force, I take it?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's both.
What about making government the enemy of business? And what does the Harvard Business School have to do with that?
The main mistake I think it made and continues to make is not understanding its role as a part of a institution that's seeking truth. And it should have been trying to keep capitalism honest. Instead, at some point, it just became a cheerleader and facilitator for arguments that arose in the out of businesses themselves, and then got this stamp of approval from Harvard. So they sort of confused what their own role in our country and society is, and sort of became handmaidens for business as opposed to constant critics. Constructive critics they could have been, but they're not even that.
You find the MBA industrial complex to have been responsible for the recession of 2008, with the Harvard Business School taking a sort of leading role. Is that going to happen again?
I think if we are going to continue to exist in a market-based economy that by its very nature allows for and almost encourages herd behavior, then we're going to lurch from excess to excess, you know, until the end of time. The point of regulation, and of course there can be some well-meaning regulation with unintended consequences, but the point of regulation is just trying to keep everyone on the road in between the lanes. It's not to try and destroy business. It's to try and stop business from destroying us.
The Harvard Business School is going to have a commencement just this week. You're probably not going to be the main speaker there. Could Harvard Business School become a force for good rather than, as you have argued in your book at great length, something that has been destructive of the economy?
Oh, absolutely. I have never once suggested that the school should be abolished, that it was a mistake to found it. I think it was a great idea to found it, and I think that schools of business that take seriously their academic responsibilities instead of, you know, letting their professors run around making consulting contracts and you know, looking for huge donations to build new buildings. If schools of business took their role seriously as constructive critics of the system in which we exist, then of course, and the brand name and their capabilities and their legacy could help them be a hugely positive force.
The book is The Golden Passport, Harvard Business School, The Limits of Capitalism and the Moral Failure of the MBA Elite. The author is Duff McDonald. He's been author of New York Times bestsellers in the past. We'll see what happens with this one. And thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.